I'm reading this morning from teachings that Ajahn Dunn gave in Canada in his visit last year. I was very moved by his visit with us when he came in May, and I found his teachings both very simple and very profound. And also within these teachings, he's mentioning a lot the importance of recognizing the true nature of the body, that it's born, it exists, and it dies. And with Iris's passing yesterday, the fragility of life is very much a powerful contemplation for me right now. None of us know when death will come, our own or someone else's, and it wasn't long ago that she was very much with us. And this is expressed quite simply by one of the great Chan masters when he said, "In the morning, a healthy friend. In the evening, a wisp of cremation smoke." These teachings are in question and answer format. Could you tell me a little bit about your teacher, Ajahn Chah? Venerable Ajahn Chah was my preceptor. He ordained me. I ordained 35 years ago in a period where his health was still strong and he was still teaching. He was a monk with a lot of metta, goodwill, loving kindness, and also a lot of wisdom. He was a very good teacher and a very good role model for his students as well. Even if I only get 50% of his qualities, it would still be good. People going to study with him had to be smart or have your own wisdom, because he taught in a way where you had to keep your eyes and your ears open. Just observe, listen, and learn that way. I lived with him at Wat Nong Pa Pong for 3 cold seasons over a 3-year period. There were times when he would give teachings or his teachings were less frequent. If his health wasn't so good, sometimes it may be 2 to 3 months before you would hear a formal teaching. However, we were always receiving teachings just by seeing him, seeing his behavior in the monastery, his deportment, how he carried himself, and also by reflecting upon the rules, regulations, and observances that were laid down in the monastery and how they created a sense of harmony and peacefulness. For 50 to 60 monks to live there, and 40 or 50 nuns were living there as well, the place was very peaceful. So just to reflect what he had actually done or was doing there. In his monastery in the evening time, between 6 or 7 o'clock, he would often be sitting at his kuti, and monks were able to go there and approach him if they had any business, or just go sit and listen to miscellaneous points of Dharma or business that was happening in the monastery. One evening when I went along there, I heard him say something just very short, but it really, really impressed me. He was saying that for people, it's so difficult to change their conceited views and opinions. It's something which is really difficult to do. For some people, their attachment to their own views and opinions, even if they are wrong, these people will still hold on to them for their entire life. He went on to say that you can blow up a mountain, turn it into rubble or dust, gradually blow it up and have, after 5 years, nothing remaining, just dust. However, the views and opinions of some people, you can try for your entire life to change them, and they will never change. They will never let go of the hold that they have on their wrong views and opinions. So you can really see the great importance of right view. It's like taking the right turn on a road, and then you go the right way. Your practice will go correctly. If you take the wrong turn, then you just keep going off. You make a detour, and you are always on a detour. He had many ways of teaching. Sometimes it would seem like he was teaching in very mild ways, but sometimes his teaching could also be quite strong. I can remember one evening going to his hut at around 5 or 6 in the evening, and there were 4 or 5 other monks there. He was just about to go off on a walk on a tour of the monastery to have a look around. As he approached the eating hall, which was just a simple hall made of iron sheets back in those days, at the end of the hall there were some ice boxes, those ones for storing ice and cold drinks, and they still had cold coffee stains on them. They had not been cleaned. So when he saw these as he was walking along, remember he was about 60 at this time and walking with a walking stick. When he saw these, he picked up his walking stick and just struck them all, and they all went rolling away. He said, "What is it with these monks? They drink, they know how to drink, but they don't know how to clean things." The monks that were with him rushed off and picked them all up and washed them. He went on to say, 40 or 50 monks come to have a drink. You have a drink but don't wash up," and then just walked away from there. After just a few steps, the conversation changed completely. He was on another topic. It never arose at all, and as we walked off around the monastery, he never returned to that topic again. You get to see, for the mind of an enlightened being, an Arahant, that their mind is in the present moment. Things arise, and then they cease. And when they cease, they cease. And they just don't keep coming up again. It was a very clear example of this. However, to look at this situation, it might be quite difficult if someone looks at it incorrectly. They would see him expressing what would look like anger by striking the ice boxes, so they would be looking at the whole situation in the wrong way. For example, if it was me at my monastery and I saw that, I would just make a verbal comment to the people. "Why have you left all of these things here? Why have you not cleaned them?" But it was his nature, his character, upon seeing these, that when he saw them, he expressed it in that way, and the monks knew what he meant. So the character of each person can be very different in the way they go about expressing things. He had many ways of teaching. For some people, he'd speak very nicely and gently. With other people, he could be quite strong and scolding or fierce. However, I only lived with him for 3 cold seasons. But in the whole time I lived with him, I never criticized him in any way whatsoever. He was always someone that I held in great esteem and elevated. So I have just explained this quite shortly. He taught in many ways. Why is it necessary to realize that the mind and body are distinct to become happy? And how does one come to realize that? It is important to change this wrong view into the correct view to see that the body and mind are separate entities. If you use your mind to reflect on the body, the nature of the body, you will see, for example, when the body experiences sickness, you realize that you have completely no control over it. You cannot tell the body to be healthy. Or as you are getting older, you are unable to tell the body to become youthful. Likewise, as the body is about to break down and die, you cannot tell it to remain on longer. And if one is still strongly attached to the body, then this will be a source of suffering for one, because it is completely out of your control. That is why you have to reflect upon the true nature of the body to see its impermanence and absence of self, so that you can let go of this attachment. For one that clearly sees that the mind is not the body, when the body is afflicted with sickness or is about to die, then this will not be a source of suffering for this person, and the mind will not be shaken or disturbed at the time of death, because they already realize that it's the nature of the body to go this way, that the mind is just merely a temporary resident within the body, just making use of it for the course of one lifetime. For anyone who has attained to any of the levels of attainment, even if one is a householder, if your wife, husband, mother, father, or children were to die, it would not be a source of suffering for you, because you know clearly already that this is truly nature happening. For an unenlightened person, when their mother, father, brother, or sister die, and we meet with this separation, it is always a source of tremendous suffering for that person. Yet for one who has attained to the Dhamma, then they are mindfully aware at the moment of death or of seeing another that has died, that this is the true nature of the body, that it's an impermanent phenomena. It's born, it exists for a while, and then it dies. So this does not perturb the mind in any way whatsoever. There is this saying that you understand death before death comes, or you see the breaking apart of the body before it actually breaks apart. You clearly and deeply understand this already. But isn't the mind connected to the body? When we feel stress, we feel it in the body. When we have the emotion like anger, we feel it in the body. Isn't there a direct relationship between the body and the mind? Yes, There is a connection. The mind does have an effect on the body, and the body can have an effect on the mind. Due to a person's past actions, their karma, you take rebirth. The mind takes rebirth into a body. It's with wrong view that we attach to the body as being oneself, and so it's necessary that one needs to have this right view to see that the body is just comprised of these elements, and that the body is born, it exists, and it dies. To develop this attitude or this correct viewing of the body, to see its true nature, that the mind, it moves throughout the body. And as we experience things in the body and we're aware of these, then with this delusion, we perceive this as being oneself. There is this attachment taking place towards the body. Say if one were to reflect upon the body, if you breathe out but do not breathe in, or if you breathe in and do not breathe out, then the heart would stop beating. At that time when the heart stops beating, the air element no longer comes into the body. When the air element no longer comes in, then the heat element is also extinguished in the body. You will probably hear of people saying that dead bodies are cool because the heat element, it evaporates, it's gone from the body. The water element in the body after death, after about 3 or 5 days, then the body starts to bloat. The water elements in the body start to search for a way to seep out of the body. Whether it's blood, pus, or other liquids in the body, they start to seep out. They return back to the earth. Likewise, the earth element in the body, that which is hard, whether it's bones, teeth, nails, skin, these things break apart, and whether it's 5, 10, or up to 100 years, ultimately they will all return back to the earth, all of these elements. And upon death, the mind leaves the body, and whatever happens to the body after that, whether they burn the body or put it in a refrigerator, you actually have no awareness of that heat or that cold anymore. We must contemplate upon the body like this, not to give rise to fear, but to realize the truth about the body and not to be careless or heedless about how we live. If one were to reflect, everybody in this room, where are we all going to? Everybody in this room ultimately is traveling towards death. There is no one in this room that can escape death. We do not reflect like this in a morbid way to give rise to fear. We do this so as to give rise to heedfulness in our life. Because we have taken these elements, we have received these elements from our parents, so we must make good use of them by the practice of generosity, keeping moral virtue, developing concentration, cultivating our mind, always working to develop ourselves more and more. By being heedful in how we make use of this body and how we develop our lives. Everybody has performed good and bad actions in their life or in past lives. And yet when the fruit of our good actions enables us to be reborn as a human, then it's necessary that we have to keep on extending this goodness, developing more goodness in our lives. For many people, being born as a human and throughout their life, they develop themselves wholesomely. They develop this practice of having generosity, keeping moral virtue, developing concentration and developing wisdom in their heart. And if upon the time of death they have not finished their spiritual practice, then there will be rebirth in the future. You can say what they have done in their life, that is their profit or their gain. And even if one were not to believe in rebirth, then it's still goodness of theirs. It's a life well led. However, for anyone who lives a life immorally, does bad things, then upon the time of death, then it's been a complete loss for them, really, their life. Some people actually believe that there may not be life after death, that there is no rebirth. And so if they live their life in unskillful or unwholesome ways, then even in the present life, there will still be discontent and suffering around them. However, for those that develop themselves in skillful and wholesome ways, then even in this present life, even if there were not a future life, they are still experiencing happiness and wholesomeness in the present. Therefore, having taken birth as a human, we should not let our days go by in vain, not let our time go by in vain. We must always be working to develop ourselves by practicing generosity, practicing moral virtue, developing concentration and wisdom. I wondered if Tanajan had encountered any difficulties in his early practice as a young monk and overcome them. If you could relate some of those in such a way that it might help us if we encounter them ourselves. When I came to ordain, I was completely ready to ordain. All interest in the lay life had been put down. For me in my practice, I may have had fewer obstacles than some other people, because ever since the age of 17 or 18, I had this thought arise in me that whatever is considered to be truly good in this life, then I wish to achieve that or to develop that. When I was at the age of about 20, I was travelling on a bus one day, and a young woman holding a newly born baby, the baby must have been around 2 months old, got onto the bus and I gave her my seat. Just looking down at this woman holding the baby, I thought, before this child grows up to the age that I am, it must experience a lot of happiness and unhappiness in life. Before it actually knows how to walk and do many things, there's a lot of suffering which it must endure in life. Reflecting like this, a sobering realization gave rise to a sense of dispassion or a sobering sadness. Also on the bus, there were some sick people, and just thinking about them and the nature of sickness, how sickness comes to everybody, then this also gave rise to this disenchantment about our state of existence, the human state. And likewise, looking at the old people on the bus, there were people on the bus who were at the age of 60 or 70 or higher than that, and thinking the aging process is a source of suffering for people. This also gave rise to the sense of disenchantment in my heart. And then ultimately, I just looked at everybody on the bus. There must have been 30 or 40 people. And I thought to myself, well, where is everybody on this bus travelling to? And the answer came up in my head. Everybody is travelling towards death. Nobody on this bus will escape death. He gave quite a long answer to this question, and I've eliminated little bits and pieces. He spoke a bit about his studies at university and times when he was feeling some attraction, and he made a vow to try and finish his studies before he pursued any relationship, and so I'll just pick it up there. I went on with my studies, and there was a time in my third year when my eye caught the attention of a particular girl, and I said to myself, well, if she's still attractive in 3 months' time, then I'll make her acquaintance. About a week after that, seeing the same girl, I saw that she was wearing a different set of clothes. And I realized that, just by her changing a set of clothes, she had lost all attractiveness to me. It just simply dropped away. There were other times with some other girls thinking, okay, I'll make their acquaintance in 3 months' time if they are still attractive. But then sometimes, within a week or so, they might change their hairstyle or something, and then, they are no longer attractive to me anymore. In truth, at that time I was seeing impermanence, but I didn't really know that, and so I was able to let go of things. I was able to put things down easily. So it happened that I never really made acquaintance with anybody because nobody was able to be attractive for 3 months. Originally, I never thought I would have this aspiration to ordain. I always thought that I was going to have a profession and have a family life. However, these experiences that I had just cut right through that, and wholesome conditioning steered me onto this path. When I was 20, it was the first time I became aware of the mind being restless and agitated. To deal with this, I tried sitting in meditation, and right from the first... Sorry, I just looked at the time and lost my place. Right from the first time I sat, I was able to make my mind peaceful, and every time I sat in meditation before ordaining, my mind would always be made peaceful. There was never once that I sat and my mind was not peaceful. This was mainly due to the strength of the concentration that I had developed in the past that was issuing results in the present, and due to the past reflections that I had done, the asubha reflections on the unattractiveness of the body. They also yielded results, so I was able to cut out my interest toward the world and was able to come and ordain. So there were many factors and causes which, when they coalesced, enabled me to decide to turn away from the world. All my previous ambition was put down. When I ordained, I was completely ready, ripe for ordination. So ever since the day I ordained, I've never once had a thought of going back to the world. So I didn't have any obstacles or hindrances right from the time of ordaining, because I was completely satisfied and completely ready to live this life. I was able to see, to determine other people to be in a supernimitta. I could always just look on other people as I wished, seeing them as being skeletons or rotting corpses in various stages of decomposition. I could just determine to look at people like this, and I could do it every time. I could look upon myself in the same way. So it was a way I could always keep control over the mental defilements. I could say that I had no desire or sexual lust arising, but I had always determined that should ever thoughts of such a kind arise within my heart, they would not be entertained for more than 5 minutes. My mindfulness and wisdom were strong enough that I could always abandon any thought of such a nature in less than 5 minutes. As for other aspects of the practice, I was very determined in my practice. I put in a lot of effort, and it wasn't so difficult for me. However, I wasn't playing around in my practice like you often see with people who are ordaining out of tradition or temporary ordinations. I was serious. I was determined that I was ordaining for life. So I knew I had to find a way of practice which was conducive to the letting go of the mental defilements. It was necessary to find how much sleep I needed to go about the practice, how much food was the appropriate amount to take, so that these two would be conducive for the development of concentration, for the development of meditation. I found for myself that 4 hours was a sufficient amount of sleep, and I found the right amount of food that supported my practice. In terms of my formal practice every day, I was doing no less than 8 to 9 hours, and I was willing to practice like this. I was satisfied and content. This is how I wanted it to be, because I was enjoying myself in the practice. I had no interest in the behavior of other people. I was more interested in just with the kalesas that were in my own heart. I was having a lot of fun in the practice, so whenever I had free time, I would just break away and go about the formal practice of sitting and walking, and I wouldn't give my time to socializing with other people. Next question, last question. I read the autobiography of Ajahn Mun with Ajahn Chah too. As enlightened beings, when they were cremated, it was that their bones became relics. Could you comment on why that phenomena happens? One of the amazing things that can happen for fully enlightened beings when their bodies are cremated is that the bones, as you mentioned, turn into very clear relics, unlike other bones of ordinary people. And this is due to the fact that their practice of continually reflecting upon their body and their mind and achieving this level of purity, that once their mind has been made pure, this purity of mind, as it's always within the body, it's like it cleanses the elements within the body. And so when the body is eventually cremated, these bones often come together in these crystalline forms or relics. When our clothing is dirty or soiled, then we have to wash it with detergents. When the mind is dirty, soiled, or defiled, then we have to cleanse it through this practice of moral virtue, concentration, and wisdom. Once the mind has been made pure, then the mind, still existing within the body, functioning within the body, that also cleanses the physical elements which make up the body, and that is why it gives rise to these relics. It is true that there is this phenomenon of relics. It does happen. However, in Thailand, you often find it's not given a great deal of importance. The greatest importance is given to one's own practice, to abandoning greed, anger, and suffering from one's own heart, to the process of purifying one's own heart. It is true, and it's quite amazing, that this can actually happen to the body of a fully enlightened being. The amount of relics will often depend on the length of time that a person was an arahant, fully enlightened, before their death. Some attained full enlightenment at quite a young age. Say, in more recent times, the Venerable Ajahn Mahabua, in his biography, he would have attained full enlightenment at the age of 40, and he died when he was 97. So you have got a period there of more than 50 years where you have a pure mind still residing within the body. So at his cremation then, or even before the cremation, his hair would turn into relics, his nails would also turn into relics, and at the time of cremation, his bones turned into these crystalline relics. The liquids within his body, which had been taken out of this body at different times, blood, pus, and different things, all these turned to crystalline relics. So you can see the amazing effect that a pure mind can have upon the material elements of the body. I myself have absolutely no doubts about the validity of such things. A few years ago, there was an instance at my own monastery. I was receiving guests after the meal, and in the clear light of day, at about 10 o'clock on the table in front of me, I had my offering cloth placed out there. This bright light manifested in the sala and went down onto the offering cloth, and one of the lay people said, "What's that? What's that on the offering cloth?" So I had a close look at it. There was a relic that had manifested on the cloth. It was the size of the nail of a small finger. It's an Arahant relic of the Venerable Siwali, who was a disciple of the Lord Buddha. So it's a very strange phenomenon, this, but it does happen. And so that particular relic was enshrined in my monastery jetty, which is being built.
I'm curious about this, you know, the sense that the mind and body are separate, and then this questioner asks, you know, but don't they have influence on each other? And I'm just curious, yeah, how to reflect on that. Like, particularly in the case of the iris, you see how strong the effect of the body is on the mind, because her confusion was due to brain cancer rather than sort of hunger forces. So I'm just curious if you have any reflections on it. Does it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it goes both ways. In the sense of the mind affecting the body affecting the mind, but then also that there is this possibility of establishing awareness. Ajahn Chah is a really good example in the sense of here's somebody with a purified mind. But then, his brain, just the actual physical apparatus of the brain, degenerating and him being both bedridden, not able to communicate generally. But then... The feeling around him was that he wasn't, say, oppressed by the body being ill or the brain being degenerate. There was a very peaceful feeling around him. And from time to time, would you see that where his mind would be able to kind of override or display its kind of separateness, so that thinking of course, at times when he was taken to the hospital his lungs filled with fluid and basically drowning his own fluids and from pneumonia and our infection in his lungs and then him retreating into the kind of the peace and stability of the mind and then that was his way of dealing with it. So that even though the body is really quite stressed, then he was able to be and have a refuge within that. So that those are sort of all of the above in the sense of the mind affecting the body affecting the mind and a certain ability to have to stand back from that, which is expressed in the Tao always in terms of the inner nature of, say, the Buddha, in the sense of quality of awakening, of knowing. One can know that the body is experiencing such and such. One can know that the mind is experiencing such and such. So that there is this ability to know. And that's where one's refuge is.